From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan, and these are the sounds of producer Tucker Martine. Actually, this is the sound of the Decemberists from their album The Hazards of Love, but the record was co-produced by Tucker Martine, and he's our guest DJ today. I started noticing Tucker Martine's name on records by guitarist Bill Frisell as an engineer, and later on records by singer and songwriter Laura Veers and Laura Gibson and Tao Nguyen, and wondered, who is this guy who produces so many of the records I love? Well, at South by Southwest this year, I got to meet and hang out with Tucker Martine. We saw some shows together, talked about music, and I invited him to play DJ on All Songs Considered. A few weeks ago, I called him at a studio in Portland, Oregon. I picked some songs that he's worked on that I thought were worth talking about, and then he brought some records he was a fan of. The conversation started when I asked him what he thought the role of the producer was.
You know, I can't believe I've been doing this as long as I have now, and I still don't have a quick and easy definition for
it. And how long is long?
Let's think. I think it's been about 15 years of doing it more or less professionally, so it feels long enough that I should have a quick and easy answer, but honestly, every time out, I feel like the role changes a little bit. You know, I feel like first and foremost, my job is to make sure that the record is great. You know, the buck stops with me. If I feel like the artist is getting, you know, lazy, you know, I'm not going to say, okay, well then, fine, I guess that's what you want to do, then we're done. I have to challenge them and get them up for pushing a little harder.
How do you do that?
To make it great.
Well, it's
that's a sensitive sort of thing.
Yeah, it is. I basically have to ask them, do me a favor, we'll hang on to what we've got. I know you feel like it's good enough, so this will be a no-risk situation, but just give me X amount of time to go down this road, and if, you know, we're not both thoroughly convinced that it's an improvement, then, you know, we've got something already. And I find that when you phrase things that way, people are usually up for stuff because all you're going to lose is a little bit of time. You know, I find that when I'm in a situation where the artist or myself is feeling afraid to try things, then those records just sound safe and boring. So I look to surprise myself and the artist in pleasant ways.
I've seen your name over and over again on records, and I have never really pinned down what your sound is. Other producers, it's really easy to nail. Atmospheric, I think, is certainly one word that comes to mind when I think of your stuff. But when I heard the opening track to the current Laura Gibson records, Beasts of Seasons, I thought, this is not your normal opening track. Let me play a little bit for people so they know what I'm talking about. Opening tracks don't usually do this.
Thank you.
I don't imagine, and I just could be wrong, but as a listener, I kind of think that people didn't come into the studio with the idea in mind for something like that to start the song. Would I be wrong?
No, that's absolutely right. In the case of the Laura Gibson record, we started the entire process by just recording her playing the songs on her nylon string guitar. We chose a couple songs where she sang live also because we felt like the vocal was just too connected to the guitar playing and they would never sound right separated. But otherwise, we just recorded the nylon string guitar and then we would overdub the vocal till we had one that we liked and then powwowed about what would bring each song to life. So in the case of a song like that, you know, it's a 7+ minute song. It's really slow. You have to just embrace that it's not for people with short attention spans, but it's going to be a slow burn. And it basically was kind of a cinematic song. And I'm a big fan of contrast. So we had this pretty gentle, quiet acoustic guitar. And I felt like we needed to get some element of tension in there, something maybe a little dissonant. And so that's where the feedback came in. Sometimes production ideas are suggested by things that you've already laid down that you feel like you can hear something else. Like you hear there's some overtones and you're looking at each other and saying, is there a, you know, are there strings? Did we put strings on this? I don't remember doing that. Sometimes those things are best left suggested, and other times they're worth, I think, trying to actually put those elements on there. And that's what happened in the case of that song. I like to think that we pulled it off, but we probably lost a few people that put that record on, and, you know, it's not a toe tapper.
Are there songs that you've heard where it was maybe the production that drew you into the song? And you're here to play DJ for us, so pick me something that maybe we can hear what you might have been attracted to, and then tell us what. We'll play a little, and then you can tell us what the attraction was.
Sure, yeah. Let's listen to Some Velvet Morning by Lee Hazlewood and Nancy Sinatra.
Some velvet morning when I'm straight, I'm gonna open up your gate and maybe tell you about Phaedra and how she gave me life and how she made in some velvet morning when I'm straight.
Flowers growing on a hill, dragonflies and daffodils learn from us very much.
I remember this song on the radio in, it was probably early 68, maybe late 67, and it was one bizarre song. Lee Hazlewood being sort of a country music singer, producer, and Nancy Sinatra, of course, the daughter of Frank Sinatra, had a few hits. What is it about that song that drew you into it? What attracted you to it?
Well, I think first and foremost, as you said, just the outright strangeness of it. I felt like I'd never heard anything like it whatsoever. On the surface, there's almost something comedic about Lee Hazlewood's delivery. I mean, I guess if you listen to the lyrics, but it's incredibly bold and sonically fascinating. I mean, I'm always looking for things with a unique sonic point of view, and that has it in spades. And I don't know, but I'm pretty convinced that there are a number of tape edits on there. There are some just wild shifts where the mix changes dramatically in a moment and the instrumentation changes dramatically that I just can't imagine somebody wrote the parts that way or played it that way or even necessarily thought of that in advance.
And there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on at the time where in multiple studios, yeah. they'd get the rhythm section, in one studio and then they'd go somewhere else and do the strings. And
I love that. I love that period for that reason, and you've got the Miles Davis Electric Records. Many of those took that approach. And, when I discovered the creative use of tape editing, that blew me away as someone getting into using the studio as an instrument and just all the creative possibilities of the studio. So that's a great example of bold tape editing and incredible arranging and a wild sonic perspective. I mean, his voice sounds like it's inside your head. I've just never, it's the biggest sounding vocal that I can think of. And yet doesn't dwarf the track. The track still has so much power. It's menacing. Some doom metal or something like that.
Well, what's your background in music? You're a musician? Yeah.
I play drums, if that counts. That's the only instrument that I consider myself proficient on at all.
But you have a sense of arranging something, here come more letters, something I don't think of in drummer terms, at least not the first thing I think of. You do have a sense of arranging. You have a sense of, certainly a great sense of dynamics and how things build.
Well, first of all, my father's a professional songwriter. So growing up, I was around that world in Nashville and exposed to the craft of songwriting.
Anything we know?
Had a bunch of stuff, really. Elvis Presley had a song called Way Down that was, I think it was number two the day Elvis died in 1977. Pointer Sisters, Barry Manilow, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bo Diddley, Reba McEntire, a lot of stuff. So yeah, he's had a good run. And I was always the guy in the bands that I was in. I was the drummer that was recording the rehearsals and listening back and, wanting to use the recording to figure out how we could make it better. And I had a lot of arrangement ideas. And I know songwriters right now are probably cringing hearing about the drummer with arrangement ideas, but...
Can you think of the beginning times when you found that magic, when you started working with tape and putting things together that might not in time have happened at the same time, but you made it seem like it's in time, or took some sort of recorded sound and added it to something that, it just didn't happen at the same time and opened your eyes and opened your ears?
It's interesting because I think having somewhat of a background, being around Nashville songwriting and whatnot, and also developing an interest pretty early on for abstract sound, I've always been trying to reconcile those worlds. Eventually, I started finding some songwriters that wanted to work with me because they loved the weird stuff I was doing. Laura Veers was one, the first record of hers we did together. It's not incredibly experimental looking back, but there were some field recordings mixed in there and some found sounds and processing that felt extreme in the context that she was an acoustic singer-songwriter with a folky bent.
You're working on a new Laura Veers record. It doesn't come out for a while, but can we premiere just a little bit of it?
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
What song?
Let's hear a track called Wide-Eyed Legless.
Hornet rain, the swarming stingers pumping poison. lover's map. Take the beating lash, lash for lash.
This was actually a song that we were fairly convinced at the time we were recording it that it wasn't going to make the record, but we thought, you know, oh, let's record it anyway. We just won't spend much time on it. And, you know, so often that happens because you're suddenly relaxed and you're certainly not being precious about it, and you're letting yourself be incredibly playful. And suddenly, in a matter of a couple hours, we just had this wonderful track popping out of the speakers, and we're kind of jumping around, you know, like dancing around the room kind of, and wondering why we were thinking the song wasn't going to be on the record.
This record's called July Flame. It comes out when?
It comes out January 19th.
Wow. And you've worked together now on what?
This is actually the seventh, if you count an EP. Yeah. So that's great, you know, to work with someone that much and have established such a common vocabulary. There's not a whole lot of explaining that has to be done when one of us has an idea, and that's a real treat.
Does someone like Laura Veer start to think of her songs in different ways, knowing that she has a collaborator like you?
Well, in her case, it's a pretty unique experience for me in that she runs songs by me to help choose which songs will go on the record. But once that's decided, she puts all her energy into getting the songwriting exactly where she wants it to be and knowing her parts cold. Then she's very hands-off at that point. She knows that I kind of love to fill in the rest of the picture, and she likes what I do usually, and she'll tell me if she doesn't. It's probably the most freedom I ever have making records, and I don't think it should always be that way, but in the case with her, I think we make something unique and special, so it works, and you know, I feel fortunate that she trusts me that much.
That's great. Go ahead and pick me another song in this DJ Land. I'm here with Tucker Martin, producer, engineer. Pick me something that maybe some of the first things you ever spent your money on, for example.
You know, the first record I remember saving up my own money for was REM's first EP, which was called Chronic Town. I had a cousin from Georgia that I would visit in the summers, and I would always hear these most mysterious, alluring sounds coming out of his bedroom, and I felt like he was in on some secret language that I wanted so badly to be in on. But, you know, he was older, and it kind of felt like I'd have to wait. But when he wasn't around, I would look at these records in his room with such wonder, and just wondering how anyone could possibly arrive at that kind of sound. To this day, I still wonder that. It sounded like it was coming from some secret society or something. You know, it's... It's a really interesting confluence of sensibilities.
I met you in Austin at South by Southwest, so I'm going to just take a stab at your... That record came out in 81. I'd put you in your... I hope I get this right, God. Late 30s, I'd say. So maybe you were 10 or something when you heard this stuff?
I was 10 when it came out. You know, I probably was 11 when I bought it.
What should we play?
Let's listen to Wolves Lower.
Yeah.
you know, I'm probably doing music for a living because I heard that record and I decided that I wanted to understand where this stuff came from, and I learned to play drums to that record, and, you know, it still sounds incredibly original to me today. I don't really know anything that sounds quite like it. And honestly, there are a lot of records I hear, I feel like I would have, I have some idea how they arrived at it, and that's one I wouldn't have any idea how to make a record sound like that. It just sounds bizarre. It kind of sounds like people that just didn't know any better, and in such a great way. I mean, the, you know, Peter Buck's guitar playing style and the sound of the recording.
The sound of the drums were good, and the where the vocal space is pretty interesting too.
Yeah, and the vocals were phonetic more than anything. I love that kind of stuff. So, speaking of vocals that are more phonetic than anything else, we could listen to a track from Mark Hollis's solo record. There's a track called "The Gift," although I love the entire record, but.
And Mark Hollis was the singer in Talk Talk, right?
That's right. And he made this solo record that came out maybe roughly 10 years ago. It's just this gorgeous blend of some kind of chamber sensibilities and folk and some kind of jazz elements, I guess, and pop. But I don't know. I guess something that often draws me to music, and there's, I guess, a theme emerging here with the REM and now this, but is music that speaks to me, but I can't possibly imagine how they arrived at it. And the compositional process on the Mark Hollis record, you know, mystifies me, but it sounds so gorgeous and natural. But I think it probably came out of a lot of improvising and then choosing, you know, really small bits from various passes. And I hear he likes to have people play to a track without hearing some of the essential elements, so they interpret it in a different way, and then he listens back to it with those elements in. And
do you ever do that stuff?
I do, yeah. I love doing that. I mean, I do it a lot on some of my own more experimental projects, like Mount Analog.
Well, let me play some of The Gift, and then I want to come back and I want to talk about Mount Analog, for if that's okay.
Okay.
Okay. Do you like to work at night?
I certainly do, and I think sometimes it's essential for some music. That's a good question after that track. It sounds like that was late at night, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And I think of the Laura Gibson opening of that song. Was that done late at night?
Well, a couple of the things were, because we were up against some deadlines. So then you just hope the next day or a couple days later, when you finally have your wits about you again, that...
It sounds good, right?
Yeah.
You can lose perspective. The name of your studio is what?
It's Flora.
You're in Portland?
I'm now in Portland, yeah. It started in Seattle. The name of the street I lived on was Flora.
So you mentioned to me a project of your own, Mount Analog. Tell me what you do when no one else is around.
Mount Analog is my chance for me to do absolutely whatever I want. And, you know, the first Mount Analog record was made with absolutely no assumption that anyone would ever hear it or that it would be a record. It was just, you know, you spend long days in the studio working with people and you hear some little interesting sound, or maybe some, you know, maybe one of the channels on the board went out and there's this really wild distortion happening, you know, then when it's Mount Analog time, I can create compositions with them. And it's not always the strangest sounds. Sometimes they're traditional instruments and music, but sometimes it might be 6 minutes of feeding several reverb units into each other with no source sound and finding that little sweet point where they start creating these tones of their own. And let's give a listen to a track called Bell and Howl from the New Skin album by Mount Analog.
Okay, and was there a movie projector, a Bell and Howl movie projector in the sounds in this one?
No, there wasn't. I saw a Bell and Howell movie projector at a yard sale while I was working on the record and thought, what a wonderful combination of words that is. And it just really spoke to me.
I've never thought of them that way. Yeah. I just think, yeah, that's great.
It'd be a good band name if it hasn't been done.
Great. Mount Analog records are there, and which one is this from?
There are two out there. This track is from the second one, which is called New Skin. I'm working on a new one, but it's really hard to find time to work on it. I can't tell you when it's going to come out, but for better or worse, there aren't scads of people clamoring to get it, so the pressure's off.
I first remember seeing your names a bunch on Bill Frisell records. Bill Frisell was a staple for us here at NPR. I used to play his music a lot as director of All Things Considered. Very, very evocative music that would take oftentimes the shape of whatever else was going on, be it in a news story or whatever segue I needed. I love his playing. To just goes right to the heart. And the head. And Why don't we go out on something? You engineered a bunch of records of him. Lee Townsend does a lot of the production. Why don't you take me out on something that that you've worked on recently with Bill Frisell?
Let's listen to something from a record we did called Floratone, which was Bill Frisell playing guitar and the drummer Matt Chamberlain. We brought them in the studio and just had them improvise for 2 or 3 days. And then Lee and I would go through it all.
Lee Townsend, the producer, yeah.
That's right. Then Lee and I would sift through it all, pick little bits, short bits and long bits. You know, sometimes it was taking a little 3 to 5 second moments and repeating them and layering them, copying, pasting, creating forms from Bill and Matt's improvisations. And then once we had sort of a form set, we'd give it to Bill, and he would write some parts on top of it, horns, strings, that sort of thing. So in the end, it ends up having a bit of a composed feeling, but it all started out completely improvised. So it's a fun way to make a record. It's a bit laborious, maybe not for those needing instant gratification, but it's really fun, and I like how it turned out. We're working on a new one now, but let's listen to The Wanderer from the self-titled Floritone record.
Thanks for doing this, Tucker Martin. I appreciate it a lot. It's really great to hear all of the sounds that both draw you to music and the stuff you put into. That's going to give me some fresh ears when I go back and listen to some of those other records you've worked on. So thanks a lot for doing this.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to talk about. Maybe I'll understand it all a little better myself through the process.
And in some ways, maybe it's just best left a mystery, because that's the fun of it, isn't it?
I like the mystery. You need to leave some of that in for sure.
Producer and engineer Tucker Martin. You can hear full versions of the music on the show at npr.org/allsongs. You can find other DJ shows there as well, including Tom York, M. Ward, Ray Davis, Jens Lechman, Randy Newman, and more. We have live concerts this week, webcast from the 930 Club by The Gossip and Dinosaur Jr., dates and times, and hundreds of other full concerts at nprmusic.org and at our live concert podcast. We also have concerts for my desk. You go to npr.org/tinydeskconcerts to find some of those. You can follow what we do on Twitter at All Songs, one word, All Songs. I'm Bob Boylan, along with producer Robin Hilton. For NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered.